The title is clunky, but the wine talk is smooth. You're listening to the Matt Talks Wine and Stuff with Interesting People podcast.
Hey everyone, and welcome to the Matt Talks Wine and Stuff with Interesting People podcast. And I'm so excited for this one. I am at Domaine Caylus with the winemaker Kelly Mason, who is one of the busiest people around. Maybe since Ann Sperling, if I talk to someone, I'm like, oh my God, how many projects are you doing? Kelly, thanks so much for being part of the podcast.
Thanks for having me.
There's so much I want to get into. Let's just start here. How busy are you?
I'm pretty busy, yeah. I'm trying to slow down a little bit if I can and take some time off. But I said a few years ago that, and it's still the same, I work Monday to Sunday. So I do 6.5 days every week. Sunday around 3 is when I slow down, and I've had a few Sundays off now, but it's busy. It's really busy. I don't think it's normal.
it's not for the normal world, but it is for this world,
for sure.
Just how encompassing it all is.
Yeah.
You're not just making wine. You're cleaning, doing 400 other things. Maybe you're working the forklift. Like you're not wandering the vineyards, the warm summer breeze tasting grapes.
No, that's the thing about this job is that we do everything and it's not as, I love when I see the pictures. I mean, we all have that photo of the winemaker standing over the barrel with a glass of wine and our hair is done and you know guys have their best shirt on. I mean, we never look like that most of the time, and we are on forklifts or walking in vineyards and it's raining and it's windy. I love when I come into like meetings with people who are not doing that kind of job but within the industry, and we're just completely destroyed, and we walk in and sit down at a table and have to start a meeting, and we don't look like anybody else at the table.
By the way, that's such a good point about the button-down shirt. You're right. I'm like, wait a minute, are this a winemaker? Are they a model at Brooks Brothers? Like,
yeah, it's always a Brooks, and there's a vest and a plaid shirt.
Yes. The vest. I never could pull that off.
Yeah.
So I'm going to bounce around a lot just about your background, your journey about Caylus. And thank you again for telling me how to pronounce it.
Yeah.
It's Quellius?
Nobody can pronounce it. But
no.
I think the way I always look at it is just it's the letter K and then loose. So it's Caylus.
I feel like that was designed just to confuse people.
And my favorite thing is that we're owned by 12 to 13 partners out of Quebec. Mm-hmm. And it starts with a Q-U-E. So like our customers, we have a huge following from Quebec. It's easier for the Quebecois to pronounce it. Mm-hmm. But in Ontario, it was really hard. And it still is, you know? Yeah. And we have a t-shirt now that actually shows you how to pronounce it on the staff here.
See, that's so smart. Because especially for us who dropped French in grade 9.
Right?
It is, we are miserable.
We get everything from Quellus and but it's, it's Caylus.
I'm curious how, you know, what was it that got you into wine? And I read this quote, you know, you're saying you always were passionate about it. And, you know, you traveled around and then your small condo, you had like 300 bottles of wine. What led to Kelly having a small condo with more wine than anything else in it?
I think I always feel like I started at a young age for wine, like when most people were probably drinking sweeter beverages, let's say. I was already interested in wine. There's always a boy involved in everything. So,
there was a boy.
He was 5 years older than me. Mm-hmm. And so that helped because he was in the restaurant industry. And he worked at a really high-end restaurant in Toronto. So they would come home at night and bring back the bottles. And all they would do is talk about this, you know, the really big wines. So this was like a 4-star top restaurant. It was a Centro at the time.
Yep.
And so I would watch them all talk about it. And I had no idea. And so to what we were talking about earlier, I was going to school in London, Ontario. They would be dropping these names. And then I just started researching it on my own. I was in university and I would go to the library and get books. And then it just grew from there, and it became more, it had nothing to do about a boy or anything. I realized that I'm really, one of my favorite things to do was read Wine Spectator. You know, and that was years ago.
Yeah. How old were you around that time?
19 okay. And 20.
Yeah. So you were definitely way, or like a usual trajectory for a teenager in Southern Ontario is it's beer, 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 big red, And then eventually you get to Europe and whites. But yeah. for you as a 19-year-old, and that totally makes sense. A guy that you're interested in, his passion, and then suddenly your own intellectual curiosity kind of took over.
Yeah, and I've always sort of been that way. I'm very studious as well, and a little bit just internally competitive with myself. And so when I don't know what was going on, I just went to the library at University of Western and got books out and studied Bordeaux. And then his Christmas present, I gave him a presentation of Bordeaux. And he was completely shocked because I was always just the quiet girl that sat around with six of them at the table.
Right.
And then I started to say, hey, no, I'm listening. I'm super interested and come and see what wines I have, started collecting and stuff.
What did you imagine for yourself before you got into wine when you're studying to be an MBA? Maybe you don't know. It's 19.
I had no idea. I was in science.
Yeah.
Thank goodness, because that helped me for wine.
Right.
But I was in science for medicine at the time. I was thinking I would go to medicine, and then had a shift around third and fourth year and thought, I think business is more what I'm interested in.
So then how did you get from that to interning at Taz?
So from doing my science degree, there's two things that I really like. And I'm fortunate when I look back, I guess I saw do something you love. I guess I had that innately in me, which I'm grateful for today, because at the time I felt really lost, to be honest. I was interested in cars. Mm-hmm. So I love cars and I like wine.
Yeah.
And I couldn't figure out what I was going to do with my life, but I said it didn't even dawn on me that you could work in wine, for the record. Like I had no idea there was any. I just read and I never looked up how you make it or anything. So I went to cars and I got a job at Magna, and I wasn't prepared for anything really. And I was just I got a job as an administrative assistant for the VP, though, of marketing. And because I love cars and had a really great opportunity working with him, he just coached me, and we had a great time. And then the next thing I know, Magna sent me off to Italy. And that's where everything started to change. I had I worked just as hard as I do today, but for Magna, that's also when I realized I need to be working for myself one day. And then I just started spending my downtime buying wine. So my salary from Magna basically funded my wine, and I was on an expatriate contract. So in the end of that, I was there for 4 years. I was 3 years in Tuscany, and then they opened up another manufacturing plant south of Naples. Mm-hmm. So then I went into like a whole other area of Italy. They're very different. North of Italy and south of Italy are completely different. And when it was time to come home, I didn't realize, but I had 300 bottles, and I had to ship them.
How did you get those back home? Because I once snuck back 18 bottles in my luggage and was scared to death at customs when I said I had two.
Yeah.
How did you get 300 bottles?
I've done it
bottles?
Twice in my life and both experiences. And I'll go, like, I feel I can tell it now because I've been, long are the days gone that I worked for Magna. So Magna sent me over with all my furniture. It was something that was happening in that era of automotive. They were moving about 20 North Americans to Italy, and they all had the contract that they would move your furniture. So I was 25.
Yeah.
I don't even know what furniture I had.
No.
It was crappy. I can tell you that much. But for some reason, that's what I had. I shipped that crap to Italy.
Yeah.
Magna paid for it. So when I came home, they had to ship my furniture back.
Mm-hmm.
But I just left my furniture there. But I shipped my wine back, it furniture.
Were you scared that someone would inspect it, and it's instead of crappy IKEA, you've got Chianti?
I've got all this wine that I ship back, and I declared some of it and had to do a spreadsheet, but for the company shipped back my furniture, and then I got all this wine. So at that time I was maybe 29, I had 300 bottles of wine, and for anybody listening, kids are living at home right now still with their parents at that age. I had an apartment. I can tell you it's not easy because you move apartments a lot at that age. Moving, I was not the girl that you wanted to come help move.
No.
Because I had so many cases of wine, and I wasn't really drinking it fast enough. And then if I fast track, so that was easy. And I was in Napa for a couple of years. And as an intern, I would also get like really good pricing. They have industry pricing on wine there. So I brought back, I don't even know how many cases. I stacked my car up and I crossed the border driving back. I got stopped again. And you could just look into my car and they're like, do you have anything to declare?
How'd you do?
And they just looked in my windows. Yeah. I have this little tiny BMW coupe. And she just started laughing. She's like, oh, I think you do. And I said, yeah, I do. So they pulled me in and I thought, this is going to be easy. I'm just going to declare it. I'm going to not at all.
No.
I got raked over the coals for that one. I got pulled in. They didn't believe like that I was an intern. They said, there's no way, you know. Oh, it was crazy. I had gone over on a NAFTA visa. They're like, no, you've been working over there. And I had to prove to them that I truly was making $14 an hour. I was an intern. They didn't believe it. And eventually I could prove it. And they were just like, this is crazy. And I just looked, I remember looking at the officer at the last minute and saying, I don't think you can understand this. And I was teary-eyed. I'm like, this is my life in my car. This is everything I've worked for. I need you to like let me take this home. I'm not reselling it. I'm like going to be a winemaker one day. And so I had to pay, I think, $600 or something. And he said, you know, you need an import license for this. You're never going to do this again, right?
Oh, my. Actually, $600. That's in my head, I had a four-figure
I wouldn't have been able to afford it. I was coming back from Napa. Yeah. At, like, you know, 14. I think I got up to $18 U.S. in the end. So right after an MBA, I went from making decent money with Magna to 14, yeah, and then $18.
You don't go into wine to get rich.
No, that's it. So that's a really long answer to how did I go from Western to Taz. But that was it. I had done 2 years in Napa. When I decided to go into wine, it was after the MBA. It was a career change.
What was your first year? What was your first vintage? And where were you when you made your first wine?
Oh, well, 2007, mm-hmm, in Carneros, yep, in Napa. Dream, like just dream environment. Everybody was awesome. But I was just an intern at the time. I was one of 10. So just doing all the scut jobs, whatever they needed. And also the weakest intern. I don't mean that physically, but just I didn't have as much experience as, mm-hmm, everybody else. They had already got 3, 4, 5, you know, harvests. And I was coming on this as a second career post Magna. So I was a different intern. I was very serious also. So I wasn't there just to, you know, travel and get paid, which is what a lot of interns do. And then they learn and they realize they love wine. And then they start to focus on their second, third, fourth harvest. I knew that if I was making $14 an hour, I had to look at it as I was getting paid to go to school.
Right. Yeah. And that is the best way to look at it.
Yeah.
So then where do you go, or how do you go from there to Ontario?
I wanted to stay in California, mm-hmm, but visas were hard.
Right.
It wasn't easy for me to stay there. So I ended up coming back home because my visa was expiring. And I knew that I wanted to get land at some point to buy it, like to have a vineyard. And I knew I couldn't afford it in California. I had a fun dream phase where I actually looked at property out there to see, but the acre price was through the roof, even if I went outside of Napa. And at the time, I think, I mean, it sounds like nothing today, but at the time in like the lower priced areas, it was 80,000 US an acre. So there's just no way. And I knew I had to come home. And what was really cool was I was coming back and I was tasting at different wineries in Ontario, and I saw a huge change in Ontario wine.
What year was this one?
2007.
Seven, right, yeah.
Right, fantastic vintage. Seven was amazing. I wasn't tasting seven then because I was coming back, but that's when it piqued my interest. And I started tasting some Pinots as well, obviously like Le Clos Jardin. I was tasting out in the county as well. And I thought, wait a minute, there's something, this is good. And I thought, how interesting would it be to come back and start when I felt like we were on a turn, like on an upward swing. And funny now that it's been a few years, I see like, yeah, there's no question that we were. And that probably started even earlier than 2007. But that's when I started to notice it.
Yeah. And how long have you been with Kilus?
Since 2013.
Okay, yeah.
And Thomas started this in 2010.
And that's Thomas Batchelder.
Thomas Batchelder. And then in 2013, I mean, it was really small when he started. We planted our own vineyard. It's in Lincoln Lakeshore, Appalachian. So the partners had bought a piece of land. I think in like 2006, you know, these kind of ideas take ages to actually get it to an up and running business if you're starting from scratch, because you've got to find the land and plant it. And so Thomas had been part of that. And then we had our first vintages in 10 and 11, and it was just a few hundred cases. But by 13, now we were up where we're sitting today. This tasting room didn't look like this at the time. It needed quite a bit of work. And then the cellar, which is just like across from us, had to be completely retrofitted for wine. And so that's what I came on board in 13. And if we all know Thomas, he's just a larger than life, you know, personality, and the opportunity to work with him for me personally was a no-brainer. So he could have told me that all I was going to do was sweep floors every day, but if I had a chance to taste with him and help him out, I would have taken the job. that was not the job. The job was huge, and I just didn't quite understand it. And of course, came on all smiles and happy. And when I look back now, I'm grateful for it. We had to build the cellar from scratch, pretty much on the inside. And he was moving in between Burgundy, Oregon,
yeah, traveling all over.
So my job at the first year was really overwhelming, and I didn't see what I signed up for. And my number one goal was, it's always this, and it was make Thomas's life easier and don't screw up.
Yeah.
So I was like high wired, and I didn't have as many projects as today, but I mean, I was here all the time.
How intimidating, was it intimidating a little bit at all? And not about Thomas, he's an incredible and very affable man.
And very generous and really nice, right? Thank goodness.
Yeah. But for you, did you ever have any nervous moments those first couple months?
Absolutely. I think I had them for the first year. I think it wasn't until year two that I started to feel better. Year one, I just felt like I was YouTubing what's a glycol system? I would YouTube we did so much work, like laying concrete, because I wouldn't even know some of the, I hadn't even built my own house. I think I had just bought my first house. So I had no construction experience for that. So I was really worried that I would make a mistake construction-wise. In terms of him winemaking and intimidating, he talks really fast.
Yes.
And he switches subjects quickly. And he goes from wine to his car to his daughters to France, back to the tank number two, back to what was in barrel.
Yeah.
So for me, it was, you have to focus really hard. And as an intern, and I'm just learning, I'd have a notepad all the time. I think there'd be a funny like movie if you would have caught that earlier. I was just always following him around. Mm-hmm. So I was always nervous. Yeah. And you don't want to let him down. Right? Those were his wines. I was executing his orders. And the first time, like, you know, when I made a mistake, I remember, and I lose sleep when I make a mistake. I wear it, you know, and making a mistake with him was, it's the worst for me. And then I watched how he handled it, and he doesn't handle it. He handles it like Thomas would.
Yeah.
Which is, it's okay, Kelly, like, you're only human. I've made that mistake like 7 times, and he just makes you feel... Like, I remember calling him. We do wild ferment here for Chardonnay, so we don't add any yeast. So what I'm really lucky about in the experience that I've had with him is that I don't know how to do inoculations, per se. I mean, I know how to do them, but that's not in my training. My training has always been wild ferment. That's all I know. Mm-hmm. Wild ferment is a totally different game than adding yeast and walking away and knowing that that tank is going to go dry. So I had Chardonnay. Well, it gives off these different odors, like these different smells as it's starting to ferment. Different yeast, strains of yeast will start the fermentation that are not necessarily the ones that are going to finish it. And I remember calling him in Burgundy, and I was freaking out because it just smelled horrible. And I thought, I've lost it. I've ruined an entire tank of Thomas's like Chardonnay. And he just laughed. And he said, no, that's totally normal. It's not normal, Thomas. You need to, like, it's not normal. And that's how we are so different, is that we're both very intense, but on a totally different level. Like a different approach.
Let's talk about your style. And, you know, for people who don't know, Kelly has fans. Kelly has followers. Kelly, for people that know Ontario wine, they will follow you around like they're following the Grateful Dead. Actually, let's start that. How does that feel?
I wish everyone could see my face right now because it's incredulous. I don't believe it still. Mm-hmm. It totally warms my heart. It blows me away. The feedback that I get, it motivates me. I would say it's like the number one thing that keeps me going every day. So when I do 6.5 hours a week, and I wake up and I'm like, I rarely wake up, I should say, and say like, I can't do this. I love what I do. So I wake up every morning and I'm, you know, 90% I'm committed to what I've got to do that day, if not 110. But then I see like someone will just write me something on Instagram or, you know, in a message, and I can't believe that they did that. So it makes me feel I can't. So anybody like, thank you so much. You have no idea. It's better than a paycheck.
Yeah.
Not that I'm looking for affirmation or anything. It's cheering me on, and I just feel like I want to make better wine for them, for those people.
But I don't think there's anything wrong with affirmation, considering you 6.5 days a week. You take a little time off on Sunday to get caught up on F1. You know, like you're putting in the only thing we don't get back is time. So that is, and when I say sacrifice, I don't mean that woe is me kind of way, but you're putting out that sacrifice. So, no, it must feel great. But then you're right. It must be motivating. Oh, they love my wine. well, I got to keep up my game because I don't want, now the expectations are high. Mm-hmm. I don't want to, you know, I don't want to upset them or not upset. I don't want to disappoint them.
I don't want to disappoint them. I don't want to disappoint myself as well. I think I'm quite self-critical on my wines, on my own wines. Like any project that I'm working on, I don't mean like Mason Vineyard, but in general, I am. And I'm trying to learn to be a little bit, like it's a good learning lesson because I'll be self-critical on something. And then by the time it gets to bottle and it goes out, I'm pouring it in my house and drinking it and saying, yeah, this is fine.
Yeah.
And I work with a fantastic assistant winemaker here. That's Brooke, and Brooke Husband. And she's just said something to me last week and she just cracked me up. I mean, we've been together now for like 4 years. So we've really got that dynamic going, you know, where you can finish each other's sentences and I can trust her and I'm fortunate to have her. And she just looked at me and she was, enough of that negative attitude. I've never heard her speak to me that way. And it was because I was talking about a wine and I said, well, that's a lot better today, isn't it? Like, to myself.
Yeah.
And I said, I didn't think I was going to like this. This is taking, turned a corner. She's like, and she goes, yes, it's palatable, isn't it, Kelly? And I looked at her and I said, Brock. And she goes, enough with the negative attitude. So because I'll be really critical. On the flip side, when something's good and I'm happy with it, I'm equally as confident that it's good. So it's like, it's a total like...
Well, as long as you can celebrate it. Like there's some people that are always negative all the time. And then when things work out, they kind of slough it off. I'm like, and my feeling is, listen, if you're going to go down to the negative, fine. It's a human quality. But when things are good, I want you to celebrate and high five 1,000 angels.
It's like my favorite moment when I taste a wine and I feel like, yeah, we've hit all the points that we want for our style, for our customers. It's a high for sure. It's a total adrenaline rush. Mm-hmm. And I think that's what I chase. Like, that's what's fun.
Well, what is the style of K-Loose? And it's funny, I still pause.
You got it right there.
I know, but I wrote it down on my screen, just the letter K and Loose. Because I remember trying your guys' wines just like once or twice about a year and a half ago. And I was like, holy shit, that's good. Mm-hmm. And then I was able to nose through a lot of the portfolio about a week and a half ago when I was here. And... you know, the Pinots are obviously, you know, that's your bread and butter, but the Cap Franc blew me away as well. But just, I was wondering if you just, what is the, if you had to describe the philosophy and the style of the wines here?
Yeah, the philosophy is do as little as possible. Mm-hmm. I think that's K-Loose's philosophy for sure. It always has been. I think it was ingrained by Thomas as well. So the philosophy is just not to add anything to the wine. And by adding, I mean, there's a lot of stuff you can add to wine, and that's getting more on the geeky side, and I'll bore people in 2 seconds, but I think the consumer is not aware of all the tricks out there. Mm-hmm. So there's two different ways, and I think you can do either style. It just depends on your volume and your customer and your price point. There's nothing wrong with adding a lot of stuff, but sometimes you have to because you're making 30,000 liter tanks.
Right.
Here at Domaine K-Loose, we have 18 tanks in the cellar. They're all the same size. It's all the same tanks, very uniform. So it allows us to do small lots. So our style is just don't add anything other than basically tartaric acid, which is like you might need that at the beginning of a ferment. We don't add yeast. We don't add anything for malolactic. Hands off, which means a load of work.
Yeah.
It's a totally different approach.
A lot of stirring, a lot of batonnage.
We have 5 interns plus Brooke and myself. Like anybody else in a larger winery.
Yeah.
Like I used to joke years ago with Richie from Fielding, right? I forget how many cases they're at right now. I'm going to take a guess and be wrong and say 30,000. His interns, I don't know. He might have 4. I have 7 here, you know, and we're maybe a quarter of the size. So it's crazy. But that's because everything that we do is about quality. So it's about hand picking, hand sorting, wild ferment. And you have to check those tanks 2-3 times a day. You can't just pitch yeast and walk away and Netflix and chill.
Yeah.
Like, it's just not an option. So that would be sort of like what our philosophy is. And our style, I think what I love about... what I love in a wine is when the nose, the mid palate, and the finish is consistent. And what I mean by that is that there's no like peaks and valleys, and it's not like it smells. you know, maybe let's just say mediocre, like you can't quite get the nose, but then you taste it on the palate and it's absolutely alive and beautiful. And then you go to the finish and perhaps it finishes on a heavier oak or it's a bit astringent. I would rather, it's okay if the mid palate's going to be full of fruit and oak and alcohol, but I want the nose to then also be explosive and I want the finish to also be long.
Right.
So I think that's what is really important with the Caylus, and I think we're doing a good job of that across the board, is that we're consistently, we don't have wines in our portfolio, at least I feel this way, that we don't like as much as other ones. We're trying to make sure that they're all consistently of a certain level of quality. Of course, you can have your favorites, and that's personal preference. But from an actual technical winemaking standpoint, I'm trying to make sure that all of them have a really nice, seamless, you know, flow.
What do you love most about Pinot, and what do you hate most about Pinot?
I hate Pinot. I am obsessed with Pinot. I really am. I'm recognizing it more and more. I am emotional about Pinot even. Pinot is it's the hardest grape to grow. Mm-hmm. So I hate that for Pinot. I hate it. I feel like every harvest, of course, I have my own grapes of Pinot, and this is what I'm talking about in this particular instance of what I hate, is that I will work as hard as I can throughout the entire growing season, and it can be beautiful, the growing season, and I feel like I got there, but it can be destroyed in September. And if you start to see bad weather in September, the first grape that's going to go is Pinot. And I hate it because I think it's weak, and I'm like, toughen up. You know, like I literally have like a relationship with it. And when it's a good growing season and it's beautiful on the vine, I'm like, look at you, you are just amazing. This is going to be, thank you, we're going to work so well together this year. This is going to, and when it's not, I'm swearing at it. And I mean, when I was in Napa, I didn't swear, and they thought that was weird in the cellar because all interns. Somewhere at Le Clos Jardin, I developed a horrible habit of just swearing all the time in the cellar because it gets under my skin, and I didn't realize it. And so, if you want to hear the most F bombs you've ever heard, they're coming out when I'm talking about like Pinot. So that's what I hate about it. Is you can grow it; it can be beautiful, but it can turn on a dime. So it's fickle. Like I feel like it's not loyal. And then
you are so emotional about it. It's not loyal. It's, oh, look at you, you're so well behaved. Or I hate you, fuck you.
Yeah, totally, you know, like, totally, 100%. And then what I love about it is I love making it. So in the vineyard, it's me. It's a competition. It's me against Mother Nature. And that's an impossible competition.
Oh, my God. You can't do that.
You can't.
You can't win. You can't compete.
I can't compete with Mother Nature. And yet, every year, I'm going to try. It's not tangible. Like, it's not. I can't. She wins. I have no control over the weather.
You can't defeat spring frost.
No, I can't. But in the tank, now when it comes in, it's the same approach. Now it's me against, like, now it's must, and it's going to be wine.
Yeah.
And that's where I feel like you will not beat me here.
Yeah.
Now, so if you suck in September and you've given me, I'm going to win in tank. And so that's what I love about Pinot, is that I love making it. I feel now like I understand it. Like I do feel like, with all humility, but that's my niche, is I understand Pinot. I understand Pinot in tank. And I would love, like, if I could just freeze the world right now and I could go anywhere else and make, I would love to go to Russian River and try to like pick 2 tons and make it. I would love to go to Prince Edward County as well. I'd love to go to BC. I'd love to go to France and just see what would happen.
Yeah.
You know, because I, like, do I really have this, or do I just understand Ontario Pinot?
They're so, I mean, the styles are so different. And,
You
know, some parts of, like, Russian River, they get too heavy. And like
they're super heavy.
I'm like, how much Syrah did you sneak into here?
Yeah.
And, you know, things like that.
I can't imagine what it would be like to have consistency in vintages. Like, even just a little bit more. I'm not saying that anybody has that perfectly, but just a little more than we do in Ontario.
Yeah.
Because that's, like, a...
So what, and for people who don't know, I should have mentioned, we're in the tasting room at Caylus, and Kelly was nice enough. She brought some barrel samples. So what I'm going to do is I'm going to do a little bit of yammering as she's pouring it. I believe it's the Cab Franc, and it is two different of the Pinot Noir. Here, let me bring my glass over. We'll make this easier. And by the way, for people listening, and, you know, I talked about this before with Vadim from Cassava. Now, hold on,
I'll line them up for you.
Okay, perfect.
So that way, okay, yeah.
Yeah, you line them up. Yeah, okay. I'll leave the glasses.
That way.
The one thing when I was in the interview I did with Vadim, we talked about price. And it's been one of the things that you'll have the debate about with people that are getting, that are new into wine, maybe they don't know Ontario wine, and they don't understand, wait a minute, I'm going to spend $43 on a bottle of Canadian wine? What are you talking about? And part of that is just, there's this perception, this negative perception about Ontario wine. But when you listen to what Kelly said, just about everything hand-picked, small yield, and basically small yield means, well, we spent that much to grow all those grapes, and 39% of those grapes we've thrown on the ground, never to be seen again. And the cost of oak, and then all the people working there. Like, it's not throw a chemical, throw a yeast, and then, as you said, Netflix and chill. It takes so much work, time, energy, and the living wage here is better for winemakers and people that work on it than in other parts of the world, yeah. Which must never be forgotten. Kelly, how did I do with my gas bagging as you were pouring?
It was amazing. And you touched on a subject that I'm really, like, I feel really strongly that there's a whole team here that's making the wine.
Yeah.
Like, you were, saying I have fans and followers, and that's amazing. But there's 5 interns that are helping us out every year that help make this wine that we're tasting today, plus Brooke and myself. It's a whole team, and the winemaker always gets the credit. And I'm sure that's probably, like, I'm out to change that, though. Mm-hmm. I think there's 2 things I would love before I die to change in the industry would be that it's more seen as a team.
Yeah.
And then the second thing would be wages in the industry. I think winemakers, assistant winemakers, and interns, the wages that they make, it's not like any other industry, and it's been accepted. It's like, if you don't take that job as whatever the role is, assistant or wine, somebody else probably will, but the pay rates are really low unless you're in one of the larger corporations. And I think that that's going to need to shift, because you can't have assistant winemakers. They can't live off of these wages. They're that low.
Yeah.
It's not a glamorous job on any level other than you have to love what you're doing, and it can't be about the money. And then eventually, hopefully, you can make some money down the road.
And if you did it by hour, like the hourly wage.
$15 to $16 an hour is what an intern is making right now.
Probably, that's for like an 8-hour day, but they're probably working 13 hours sometimes.
Yeah, I've seen a shift there, which is nice. I think more wineries are paying overtime.
Mm-hmm. Oh, that's good.
So that's great. We pay overtime here at Domaine Kaylee. I would say we treat our interns really well. And over the years, I've had the chance to meet some amazing, like, Niagara College students, and they're coming here to learn. So we're attracting young talent, which is really exciting. So you want to talk about these wines?
Yeah, what do we got?
Okay. So, I didn't even think about a spittoon. It's, what time is it? It's 10:52. Okay.
Well, that means in 8 minutes it's legal to serve alcohol.
Yes,
in
totally.
Restaurants.
Okay, so I've poured. So these are all 2020 vintage, and I poured for you 2 barrel samples of Pinot Noir. Mm-hmm. These are both off of our estate vineyard, and I think it's just to kind of show you a little bit, maybe a quick sneak peek into what the 2020 vintage was like, and what the base is sort of for our Pinot Noir. These are Grand Reserves, so these are barrels that have already classified as Grand Reserves. So winemakers will go in and taste every single barrel to come up with a blend.
Right.
That alone is months of work.
Yeah.
We can give these a try.
I got left to right. What do I got?
Yeah, so I did it in order of... starting from your right is barrel number 36.
Yep.
And then the next one is barrel number 294. And so these are the same parcel in our vineyard, just different barrels. And there's no new oak on these. These are neutral. But you'll just see how differently they age. And it's going to be really minute, I should say. Probably, I'm not sure that's going to be obvious. This might be something where it's obvious to winemakers, because we're so detailed and geeky about wine. And I'm just going to open up my notes here
see.
So in theory, okay, let's watch how much... how bad this is. 294, which will be your second one.
Yep.
That's going to should be your bigger one. So my notes are just saying this is really big in structure. So when I'm going to go do blending, this has really hot, like, strong tannins for Pinot. It's really dark. It's all dark fruit. You can see that as you're swirling it. So for me, and from a blending tool, this is going to be the structure, the framework for the Grand Reserve, and also to help it age. We need those tannins, and I need that. It's not going to be pretty and elegant. That's what I said, like 3 weeks ago in the cellar, so.
Now, wait a minute. You picked up the first one. I'm holding the second one.
Oh, yeah. You're on the second one. Yes, you're right. Yes. Thank you. Yeah, yes. I'm on the lighter one, but that doesn't smell too light.
Yeah. Just so that we're on the same page.
Yeah, okay.
Yeah, you're right about the dark fruit.
Right. Mm-hmm. That's big tannins for Pinot, don't you think? Like, mm-hmm. you've especially this early. You can feel it right here, right now, right?
The pucker is there.
So, and I'm not sure that number 36 is really going to... I said this one's more earthy, and it's got lots of layers to it.
The first one.
The first one is very earthy. The second one is going to be earthy as well. So if we try, let's try number 36 and just see. This is giving you an idea, though.
Wait, you picked up the second one again.
Oh, I did it, because I'm doing this way.
Yeah.
So you know what we do is we actually use a Sharpie and we write. And I was thinking, I don't have a Sharpie for us.
No, I know, but also you're holding a mic, you're talking, you're looking at your notebook.
I'm not used to holding a mic.
Yeah, yeah.
I can see right around the nose. This is a little more what I call Pinot perfume. Mm-hmm. It's a little bit already prettier on the nose, whereas that was all just really dark. This one, you're starting to get some of the florality of Pinot.
It's a lighter finish.
Mm-hmm. Mm-hmm.
Yeah. Oh, but the tannin's still there.
Mm-hmm. I can't knock the tannin down.
No.
That's 2020.
Okay.
Right, so we said the perfect 2020 vintage.
Yeah, and okay. Before we get thoughts on 20, your thoughts on the two wines, 20 vintage, different barrel. But yeah, like you grabbed this is a barrel sample that you brought up.
Yeah, yeah. I mean, because we don't have the finished wine yet. I have now done the blend. It's in a little small jar.
Yeah.
Like a representative blend, and it'll go to tank in about a couple weeks. We're just getting ready to bottle. If you poke your nose in the cellar right now, you can take about 10 steps. You have to turn 10 steps. Because we have glass everywhere. We're just about to go. I love the second one better. Mm-hmm. The first one.
The bigger yeah. More
Sorry, no, the first one, 36.
First one,
36. The first one,
lighter,
I like it because it's
earthier.
Lighter. Yeah, it's earthy, but I love when you get that floral kind of note with Pinot. I think Pinot, I mean, this is my, Pinot should have the best nose possible ever because that's what Pinot, think of great Pinots that you've had in your life.
Mm-hmm.
It should get you instantly on the nose. It should be the most seductive nose ever. You should want to take a sip of it. And so for me, nose is important on Pinot, and then hopefully that it follows through on the mid palate. I like the nose better on 36. But when I'm looking at these two wines, I'm not looking at them as isolated in a bottle. This is going to go in with 10 other barrels and form a blend. So
right.
I'm pulling from each of them what component. It's a very technical tasting. It's not, you know, about do I like this as a whole. In theory, you don't need to like this as a whole. You need to be able to see what parts of it is going to help in the sum of the blend. And so that's sort of what this is. And it shows you a little bit about what 2020 is for Pinot. It was a hot vintage, right? Thank God it wasn't my first vintage or second. I'm glad it wasn't 2013 and Thomas was like moving around and starting here. I would not have known. I would not have succeeded, probably.
So we'll do the Cab Franc in
a
second.
Sure.
By the way, again, appreciate it's always fun trying to preview it, and that is a great way of putting it. You're not here to love it. You're here to realize, okay, I'm going to take that and that, and we're going to play with that guy over there,
yep.
Throw a little bit of this and a little bit of that.
Yeah. Yeah.
It's like no one ever takes a thing of garlic and takes a giant bite and goes, I am happy, but you're going to use that garlic in the sauce.
Yeah.
So everyone raving about 2020. I've talked to a lot of winemakers. I say 2020, and they get ebullient.
Yeah,
I mispronounced it. They get happy, big joy in their face. But you said you have a bit of a different take on 2020.
Yeah, I think, and I have to. If you follow Wines in Niagara, that's Rick Van Sickle's.
Yep.
He does an amazing every year. He gets the winemakers to write what is their thoughts on the vintage, and it's a long piece that he does, and he collects it. So for those of you that are really geeky and want to see a vintage as opposed to like seeing a general vintage report, you can get it from your favorite winemaker. And I think that my report was something like. For me, it was really challenging. As I mentioned earlier, I'm glad it's not my first because everything here is wild ferment. The death of wild ferment is high alcohol because the natural yeast will only go so far. Whereas if you inoculate those yeasts, some of them have been picked for strains to take you to 14% alcohol. 2020 was the most beautiful vintage. There's no question. Even with that would be the one where I was walking through the vineyard and talking to the Pinot and being like, hey, thanks. Like, good job. High five. Brought it in and it was clean and there was no disease. It was fantastic. But you had to pick Pinot in 2020, I think, early. So you had to be careful and watch your Brix level. So for me, 2020, I felt like, thank goodness I had had the 2015 vintage, which was also a warm vintage, to kind of see, you know, what I might be getting down the line. So I picked a little bit early. I mean, look how big these wines are still.
Yeah.
And so I think 2020 was really hard because everything is wild ferment. And if you have high alcohol, it won't finish. for the wild, like I would love to grab all the wild ferment winemakers, and we all had the same thing. Everybody that wasn't wild loved 2020, but I would talk to like Matt Smith at Cloudsley. I would talk to Thomas, of course, and I've known Matt for years, and literally the phone call I would pick up, I would see he's calling me, and it wouldn't be like hello, it would just be F-bomb, Pinot, F this, like, and we would just go, and then I would give him a minute, and he would go, I've got this issue, and blah, 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 blah. Like, yeah, stupid 2020, and we'd hang up the phone. It was just a vent, and then he'd call me a week later, we'd just go.
Yeah. By the way, I'd love for someone who's not into wine at all to get a transcript of you bitching with someone else and be like, what language is this?
You
this,
wouldn't understand it. Yeah. Like, I can remember, so what, like, he would call me, and last year, it would just be ridiculous. And we would just be like, there'll be an issue. Every harvest, there's an issue. But there was like five for us in 2020. And you were constantly, constantly going. And nothing was dry, like finished fermenting at Christmas. So we'd be like, there goes our Christmas. There goes everything. We're checking. What do you got? And Chardonnay's not like just starting mallow, not done mallow. And it would just be F in this, F in pH, F in like this. And yeah. And he sent me pictures. And like, and 2021 was a really rough harvest. I think that's where Matt and I were really going. But 2020 was hard for wild ferment winemakers. So for the people out there, for the, you know, the people like Thomas who does wild ferment, I think Cloudsley does a lot. I'm going to miss people that Hidden Bench does. It's a whole other game because you cannot bring in grapes at 25 Brix. And Ontario had Brix that high. We were California that year.
Ooh.
So great for Bordeaux.
Yeah.
Right?
Great for the Cab Franc, we're going to try. Not so good for the Pinot Noir.
Right. And not so good for the Cab Franc either because we're wild fermenting.
Right, right. Yeah.
But
yeah,
I'd love a big Cab Franc. Like, on hindsight, we should have just inoculated everything. But we just don't. So it was managing all of that. And it was super stressful.
Good for you, by the way, sticking to the philosophy.
Yeah,
you could have been tempted. You could have been tempted.
Yeah, yeah. And you're definitely tempted. There's times because you're not sleeping.
Yeah.
But anyways, it's done. And I think it's a beautiful wine. And that's why I love Cabernet Franc. Not as much as Pinot, but it's a really close. I don't think I'll ever love anything as much as Pinot.
But I have a philosophy. If you like everything, you love nothing.
Yeah.
You can't treat everything the same.
No. You know? No, and I think that's what's cool. Like, personality-wise, like, you should know who you are and where you stand. And I feel like it just comes out of me naturally when it's about Pinot. So that's definitely my pocket.
So what do we got here with the Cab Franc?
So this is 2020 Cab Franc Reserve. The Reserve's always been one of my favorite wines. And I've just pulled this for the listeners, for Matt, from Tank. Mm-hmm. So it was recently filtered. Maybe 2 weeks ago. Oh, yeah. There's the nose. The noses are beautiful on Cab Franc in 2020 because we all got it ripe.
Yeah.
Right and ripe.
Yeah. And no, you know, the one thing, just... You don't want a lot of green or any.
Mm-mm. I love texture in wine, and I like the texture on that, on the mid palate.
Oh, yeah, 100%. And I'm not just saying that because you just said it, but it was one of those ones where as you're drinking it, you just smile.
Yeah, and it's silky. Like, I really love the mid palate texture of a wine. I don't like when it's astringent or sharp.
Yeah. No, by the way, for people who don't know, when they see Reserve, what does... You know, like, what does it mean for you guys? Because I imagine it would be similar for other wineries in this area.
Well, for us, it's declassification. So it's our best barrels is what, in this particular case with Cab Franc. So, and it's also a specific block in the vineyard that we've now learned over time just gives us a better quality. Mm-hmm. We have 4 blocks of Cabernet Franc on our vineyard. We experiment with different clones. So we've planted... 214 and 327, and they're very different in nature when you get them in the tank. So we pick between those 4 blocks, but consistently 2 blocks are really the Reserve. Mm-hmm. And then we'll taste through those barrels and then decide. Not all of them will make it into the Reserve. We also make a tradition. And so what you're tasting today is it's the best barrels of the Cabernet Franc for 2020. And when you have a great vintage like 2020, you can imagine when you're declassifying barrels, those barrels are really good too. So you can get in a winery, tradition, or our tradition is really strong in 2020 as well, and it'll probably be the case across the board for Ontario. So you're going to want to snatch up 2020 reds for sure.
Oh, I know. I know. I'm already going to send a message to like Thomas and
whatever, and your favorites are. I tasted his 2020 Pinots this week, his single vineyards that he's, and they're fabulous.
Yeah.
Like, they're amazing. And they are also bigger, too, in style, like a little bit. But he still has that beautiful perfume.
Was he okay with that?
Yeah, I think, you know, he loves it. Yeah. And but he has such a neat way of still balancing out the wine. It's not as big as, say, you know, like whatever the 248 barrel was for us today. But they're beautiful. Yeah.
How are you feeling about that Cap Franc?
I love it.
Yeah.
I love it. Yeah, that's one of the wines that where I stand in front of the tank and go, yep.
Yeah.
That's good. I feel happy about that. I'm proud about that. I love this wine for sure. One of the perks of being a winemaker is we always get a little allocation. And so I get an allocation of this wine, and I can always tell which ones are my favorite because they're gone out of my basement faster than the other ones. And Cab Franc Reserve is always one of them for sure. From Caylus, it's one of my favorite. I love Cab Franc in general, so it's great. The
funny thing there is, yeah, you can get all technical and about the acid and about the tannins and the alcohol, but in the end, you can throw it all away. If you want to know what your favorite wine is, just go look and see what you got left and what you don't.
Right.
It's my raisin theory. People that say they like raisin cookies as much as chocolate chip. I'm like, okay, go to the bakery right before they close. There's going to be no chocolate chips, but there's going to be row after row of raisin cookies. So get out of here with this raisin cookies as good as chocolate chip.
Yeah, and the important thing is figure out what you like. Yeah. That's what's important to the consumer. It doesn't have to be so complicated. Figure out, like, wine doesn't have to be, you know, the way that winemakers talk about it, it's super complicated. We dedicate 2 years. Everything that you're tasting today is 2 years of the whole entire team's life, you know? But figure out what you like. And that's how you can just, you know, define your palate. And if you like residual sugar, or do you like cool climate, warm climate, hopefully you like a lot of everything. Because that's okay too. You know, for a consumer of wine, like as much as you can. And then teach other people. I think where we're at in Ontario right now is, or what I'd like to see more of is, for all of the supporters out there and the people who love Ontario wine and put it on their table, thank you. And keep putting it on your table, because when you have 8 friends over for dinner and you put, you know, Caylus on the table, any of them, Hidden Bench, it doesn't matter, you know, you are educating Ontario or your friends. And they will now go and say, ah, okay, I want to try this. And I think that's where we're at. And really the people that are going to push the needle for us is actually the consumers, I think, right now. And of course, the amazing Psalms and everybody in restaurants that are also helping to tell the story.
It's all about telling.
And yourself, like podcasts on Ontario wine, right? That's what we all need. We just need momentum and to keep going.
And the main thing, and I've said this over and over, so I hate being a broken record, but the reason why people should buy wines from Niagara, Prince Edward County, you should not do it for nationalism. You should not do it for, I mean, I love the idea of supporting local, drinking local. But the number one reason you should do it is it's damn good. I've done tastings where we've compared it, where we've done, I've done, you know, Prince Edward County Shard up against some Premier Cru Burgundy, and it holds its own. A little while ago, I had an 02 spec Cab Merlot, and it was up against an 02 Latour. Now, the Latour was still, you could tell there's more going on there, but the spec Cab Merlot deserved to be in the room, you know, and that's, you know, that's the important thing. No. You mentioned Rick Van Sickle, so let's quote Rick Van Sickle article about you. I'm going to quote you to you.
Okay.
When I think of it, really, I've been quietly creating this brand over the past 10 years by owning and working in my vineyard. What does Mason Vineyard mean to Kelly Mason?
Yeah, it's definitely, not to put this lightly, it's a check in the box, because that was always my intention. And for all of us at home that write goals and, you know, you can, I'm telling you, you can do it. There was times where I doubted myself, like, was I really going to actually launch? Things were going so well with the other brands that I was working for. It was easy to just say, I can just coast, you know, but every morning I would wake up and look at those vines and I would say, no, you did this for a reason. And the hours that I put into the vineyard, it was always so that one day those grapes would come to a bottle that I would make. Mm-hmm. And so to me, yes, it really was 10 years of me quietly making lists, quietly dreaming, but also being focused. It was going to be a reality. And for me, it just means the next step. Like, I did it. Yeah. I realized at a point that I didn't want to not do it. I would rather do it and fail than not do it and be 80 years old sitting somewhere and saying, once upon a time I thought I would do a label, or worse, have a friend say, why did you never make your own wine? Oof. I did not want to answer that question.
Yeah.
And I really just had this moment where I was like, I was thinking, I don't ever want to have to say that to somebody. I would rather say I did and it didn't work out. And now I can happily say I did, and I'm having the time of my life, and it's so much fun.
There's nothing worse than what if. I think if you look in life, the worst emotions or thoughts what if is at near, if not the top of the list of the worst thing to have.
I agree. And I would say to anybody, like, don't have that. Unless your what if is absolutely ridiculous.
Yeah.
You know,
what
like.
What if I'd become an astronaut? I really should have been.
What if I was an F1 racer?
Yeah.
Like, I should maybe change my life and go back and apply. That's a little out there.
Yeah.
And I wish I was, because at 16, I actually thought about it. But that's not a serious what if. But if it's a what if where you have the skill set and you've actually put in the hours and everything in your life is you've got the aptitude to do it, but you're just afraid or whatever, that's a serious what if, and you need to conquer that.
So tell me a little bit. I never see your wines. I imagine it's a tiny amount. I imagine it's never at the LCBO, maybe the odd restaurant. I bet it sells out super duper quick because of your cult-like followers. what are the wines? What do you make? Yeah. How much?
I make Pinot Noir, Cabernet Franc. I have to think about this. So Pinot Noir, Cabernet Franc, and Chardonnay that nobody's seen yet, because I just did my first harvest. I planted Chardonnay, so this is young vines. You won't see that till 2023. And then I do sparkling as well. And then I also do something called the collab series. So Mason Vineyard is 100% fruit off of my own vineyard. So it will only ever be as big as my vineyard. And then I do something called the collab series, which is part of, I'm really excited about that, because ever since I stopped working with Thomas, I realized that I needed a mentor in my life. I liked mentoring. And so the collab series is a way for me to work with other winemakers and keep learning and get pushed outside of my comfort zone. And so there's the first one that I did was also to thank Brooke Husband, who's the assistant winemaker at Domaine Calus. She's also assistant on all the other projects that I'm on. Was a way to thank her and also say, hey, you know, they don't get the recognition. How many assistant winemakers get their name on the front label? Nobody does. And so I thought, this is the start to change that. So my very first one was a rosé with Brooke, 100% Gamay. We were co-winemakers. Her name is on the front label. And so that's, every year I'll do collabs with other people. And so I have big ideas for that. So that's sort of what Mason Vineyard is about. There's the group of wines that are right off my vineyard, and then there's collabs, and I have new collabs coming out soon for this year.
Can I ask you for a favor?
Uh-huh.
Would you do another one of these interviews?
Yeah, sure.
We are near done. I'd still go, but technically we're in the tasting room. It's after 11 a.m. there are people like me that go to tasting rooms right at 11 on weekdays, because I try never to go on a weekend. This has been fantastic. Mm-hmm. But promote, where can people find your wines, Calus?
Yep. Yeah, sure. So for Calus, we're in St. Anne's. It's not too far from Vineland. Come on by. It's you can just look us up on the internet and then come and visit. I'll add for Calus that we're having a really fun time right now here. We have a really young, dynamic team, and we're shifting things a little bit. We have some great events coming up. We'll do industry nights and some cool, Brooke and myself will be in the tasting room coming up on a few Fridays in the summer. So it'll be actually tasting with the winemakers. So come on by, and you can meet myself, you can meet Brooke, and also this amazing young team. I think we're owned by 13, private investors. If I can say this with all respect to them, they are fantastic. They're all probably over 50. So we're from this like amazing classic traditional brand, but when you come to see us, our number one thing is that you get really personal attention. We want you to try all the different wines, and we're kind of like a younger team right now, so I'm really like excited for this summer. Mason, www.masonvineyard, that is sign up. I'm not going to e-blast you with a bunch of emails. If you're interested in purchasing, you need to just sign up, because I'll send you out an email when the release date is. And Hansberger Estate is in Jordan.
Yep.
And oh my gosh, go and visit Hansberger. If you're in Niagara, go for lunch for sure, for their pizza. Try the wines. One of my favorite Cabernet Francs is there. And it's just the most beautiful property. It is gorgeous. They also do amazing weddings, and they have a restaurant as well. And a lot of wild animals.
All right.
And a crazy family.
Kelly, thank you so much for doing
this. Yeah, thanks a lot for asking me to do this. I had a great time.
Thank you so much.
Thanks.
Again, everyone, thank you for listening to the Matt Talks Wine and Stuff with Interesting People podcast. Remember, you can find me on Stitcher, Spotify, iTunes, and wherever quality podcasts are sold.
Thanks for listening to the Matt Talks Wine and Stuff with Interesting People podcast. Happy hunting.